Probleme. Convention, Christian Home Educators Association. As a matter of fact, they're about. So it was kind of fun being in the booth yesterday and keep seeing members of our class coming by and talking to us. And Kathy's there manning the booth this morning. And I'm going to ask you not to hold me very long after class today because I need to get back down there and relieve her. So that's where I'll be spending my afternoon. But appreciate your prayers, too, because there's a lot of pressure. Got in this year, and that's one reason why we're having such a strong presence at the convention. We really want to see if we can maintain a foot in the door. And I was amazed how many people came by and just said, we're so glad you're here. And we're just praying that message would get through to the board and allow us to remain there. Now, what really helped is one of the foremost curriculum people, Sunlight Curriculum, this year changed their policy and is allowing our material to show up in our catalog. And we're hoping that will enable us to maintain a presence there. Because I'd sure hate to see the Christian Home Educators movement go in the direction of anti-science in their stance on education. So I appreciate your prayers, not just for this weekend, but for the next few months, that we'd be able to find some way to maintain a presence there. Okay. We're in the book of Genesis, chapter 6 and 7 of Genesis right now. And I'm going to try to finish what I started last week. And what we got going into last week was the principle of universality. One of the things we've been emphasizing in our Genesis question book is that the chapters 6, 7, 8, 9 of Genesis teach the universal flood. And sometimes that gets misinterpreted into a brouhaha over whether or not the flood was global or local. When in fact the text is really stressing the universality of the flood. It's a different point. And this controversy, and I mentioned in weeks past that it's probably more of a divisive issue within the church and certainly outside the church than what people believe about Genesis chapter 1. You know, personally, over the past 15 years with Reasons to Believe, I've noticed that this tends to arouse more acrimony than any other chapter in the Bible or any other issue in the Bible, the extent of the Genesis flood. But as I've mentioned before, too, this is a 20th century phenomenon. Christians did not fight over this interpretation of the Genesis flood until the 20th century. And so today I'm going to want to take you through some Bible verses that I think will help elucidate why this is a 20th century problem and how we can use these Bible verses to try to quell some of the heat of the controversy and really move on to the main points of the text. It's interesting to me that people fight over the geophysics of the flood when in fact the primary message of these flood chapters is about judgment. And again, I want to emphasize that in order to correctly interpret the geology of the flood, we must first understand its message of judgment, and that's why we've been spending so many weeks getting into what the sixth chapter says about the condition of people at that time and how God was rescuing humanity from self-extinction. Humanity had changed into such a wicked or reprobate state that the human race was in danger of wiping itself out. And so God intervenes to prevent that from happening. And, you know, we've gone through these statistics where during the days before the flood, we're looking at a minimum of 19 out of 20 people dying a death of murder. And so with a murder rate that high, and of course with a murder rate that high, guess who tends to get murdered more often than the others? The righteous are a little easier to knock off than the wicked, and so this kind of explains why the human population so rapidly evolved into a reprobate state. the righteous were being selectively killed off, and the wicked were surviving, but it got to the point where they were killing one another too. And with a murder rate exceeding 19 out of 20, indeed the human species was in grave risk of self-extermination. And this will also help us understand the sentiment of the ninth chapter of Genesis when the subject of murder is addressed. You know, we'll cover that later, but you see some very strong language in that ninth chapter, and a lot of Christians today, especially in the Episcopalian Church, get very disturbed by that language. But we need to understand there's even stronger language in this sixth chapter of Genesis describing the wicked state of the human species at that time. I'm not going to go over it again, but what you find in the sixth chapter are adjectives describing the wicked condition of humanity. And it's the most extreme adjectives you find anywhere in the entire Old Testament. There's no other group of people that are described in such extreme terms, in terms of their the degradation, the depth of their evil, and the extent of the evil. So every person was thinking only evil thoughts all the time. So I mean, it's like they weren't even capable of coming up with a good thought. You couldn't find anybody who would have that. And how every action that they were performing was one of malice. That's a word that means motivated to physical assault. So everybody was physically assaulting one another. So this is the situation. But the reason why in the 20th century there's been this movement towards interpreting the flood as global, probably one verse more than any other is responsible for this confusion between universality and globality, and it's Genesis 7:19. I mean, I just hear that all the time in our Reasons to Believe ministry. And what that verse says the waters, referring to the flood waters, rose and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. The waters rose greatly on the earth, and all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. That's the New International Version. And people in the 20th century look at that and say, well, there's really no other way to interpret that other than all the highest mountains indeed were inundated with water on the face of the entire surface of planet Earth. And I'm going to throw into question that particular conclusion. And as we mentioned last week, one way to do that is what you see in the very next chapter, chapter 8. It speaks about Noah. Verse 5 says the waters continued to recede until the 10th month. And on the first day of the 10th month, the tops of the mountains became visible. Became visible to whom? Noah. Okay. We drop down three more verses. Verse 9, or verse 8. It says, Noah sent out a dove to see if the water had receded from the surface of the ground. Notice he could see that the hills and mountains were now dry. But he sent out this dove to see if the water had receded from the surface. And verse 9 says, the dove could find no place to set its feet because there was water over all the surface of the earth. So here's a verse where it says there was water over all the surface of the earth. The context clearly indicates that that was not true of the hills and mountains that Noah could see. The difference is, from Noah's perspective, he could see dry land. From the dove's perspective, all the dove could see was water. So from the dove's perspective, there was water from horizon to horizon. From Noah's perspective, there was not. Which means we go back to Genesis 7:19, where it talks about all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. From whose perspective? Again, it's from Noah's perspective. So in terms of Genesis 7:19, all he could see was water from horizon to horizon. There was no evidence from his perspective of any dry land on the surface of the earth. That does not mean or necessarily imply that Mount Everest was covered with water. There's no way that Noah could even see Mount Everest from where the ark was floating. The other thing that I think it's careful to point out is this term, all the high mountains. And one translation puts all the highest mountains. King James doesn't use the word mountains at all. It says the hills. And so, you know, what's going on here? What's going on here is a typical problem translating from Hebrew into English. Again, I want to remind you, biblical Hebrew has a vocabulary size, total vocabulary size, of 3,100 words. If you forget about the obscure proper pronouns. So if you forget about all the names of the cities and the towns, you only have 3,100 words. English, by comparison, has over 4 million words. And so whereas in English, we have a lot of different words to describe the geology or the relief of the area around us, in biblical Hebrew, you have very few words. And so there's this word. The word that's there in the original for mountains is the word har. And I've written in the Genesis question, it's got multiple literal definitions. It can mean hills. So that explains the King James translation. The word can just as well be translated hills as it could be translated mountains. You say, well, how high of a hill does it need to be before it's a har? Well, the sense of the definition of the word is that it's some item of geological relief that's elevated above the plain. So in that sense, if you had a real big pile of garbage in your backyard, you could call it a har, as long as it's elevated above the rest of your backyard. Now, if it turns of a hill, it needs to be a hill that would stand out from the plain around it, or a mountain that stands out. So it can refer to a towering peak. It could refer to an isolated mountain or a group of mountains, or it could refer to hill or hills or even mounds. Anything would qualify. You say, well, you have this adjective governing the word har, translated here, all the high mountains. The adjective is Gabbah in the Hebrew language, and it can mean high, but it also takes on the definition of elevated above. So, for example, when you look at King Saul, he was elevated above his peers around him. He was high. He was tall compared to his peers. And likewise, that's what's going on here, is talking about the hills, mountains, or mounds that are elevated above, higher than the rest of the relief around them. Well, where did the ark begin to float? Somewhere in the Mesopotamian plain. The Mesopotamian plain is really flat. And so it's referring to these hills and mountains around it that would be above, elevated above the plain in which the ark is floating. You say, well, how high of a hill are we talking about? Well, my guess is it would have to be at least 50 feet high. Maybe 100 feet high, maybe 1,000 feet high. It doesn't really tell you that much about how much water. But nevertheless, just looking at it in that context, we can understand there's no need to interpret it that all the mountains of the Himalayas were covered with water, or even all the mountains of the Caucasians were covered with water. Simply that from the perspective of Noah, he couldn't see any hills, any mountains, any mounds, was water from one horizon to the other. This is also consistent with the verb there for cover. It says the waters rose, they rose greatly on the earth, and all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. The Hebrew verb for cover is kasah, and you get three different definitions for kasah in the lexicon. It could be interpreted as water that permanently covers these hills. Or it could be interpreted as water that runs over the hills. Or water that falls upon the hills. So you got three different possibilities here in Genesis 7:19. We're looking at a lot of water falling as rain upon those hills. Or we're looking at a lot of water that's running over those hills. Or we're looking at a lot of water that remains upon the hills. And you say, well, how much? Well, it's 15 cubits worth, and if you're looking at a short cubit, that means we're seeing a minimum of 22.5 feet of water, and you say, well, what's the most? A long cubit is about 3 feet long, so if you go with a long cubit, then you've got about 45 feet of water. Now, if we're talking rainfall, that's a lot of water coming down out of the sky. And it all comes down in 40 days. So I can't imagine 20 to 40 feet of water coming out of the sky in the space of 40 days and anything surviving. It will be total destruction, and people aren't going to survive that kind of a rainfall. And if you're talking 20 to 40 feet of water running over the hills, likewise, I can't see anyone surviving. That's another scenario, that the rain was extremely heavy in the hills around the Mesopotamian plain and caused a flash flood to rip through that whole area. Well, if we're talking 20 to 40 feet of water moving at, say, 40 miles an hour, what's going to survive? That's going to knock down all structures, kill everything in its path. And again, if you're talking 20 to 40 feet of water permanently remaining upon the hills, there's a limited amount of time that the inhabitants could tread water. And so, in that sense, I would say it doesn't really matter how you interpret Genesis 7:19. Any one of the three scenarios that the definition of the word permits will guarantee complete destruction. I mean, one 20th century rebuttal I've heard is to say, well, you know, couldn't the pre-flood peoples have simply run out the flood? Not if you're talking that much water. In other words, if you're kind of sitting in your home and say, gee, a lot of rain's coming down, and maybe we need to leave. If you've got that much water coming down and that broad of an area, the entire Mesopotamian plain, again, no one's going to escape. So the idea that the pre-flood inhabitants could have simply packed up their belongings and headed for the mountains really isn't realistic, not given the quantity of water we're talking about. They're not going to make it. They will be wiped out. Their homes and structures will be destroyed. Nothing will be left. So again, in that sense, properly looking at what the original words are there, there's nothing that compels us to interpret this as a global flood. Now again, what we've been saying is the text is emphasizing a universal flood. By universal, it means no exceptions. Every human being is destroyed by the flood waters. No one survives except for those on board the ark. No birds and mammals associated with human beings likewise survive this flood. They're all wiped out, so it's universal in that sense. Everything is destroyed that's earmarked for destruction in Genesis chapter 6. The birds and mammals associated with the pre-flood inhabitants and all the pre-flood inhabitants except for those on board the ark. So in that sense, nothing survives. It is universal. It is total destruction. Now, kind of what we led up to in getting here was that our little study on judgment, God's judgment wrath. We see throughout the entire Bible that God limits the expression of his wrath, his judgment wrath, to the extent of human reprobation. And then we saw this laid out, for example, with Sodom and Gomorrah, where God said, yes, those cities are history. They will be totally destroyed. So there's another example of universality. When God deals with reprobation, he wipes it out totally. And the cities of the plain were wiped out totally. But he told Abraham, I'm not going to do that to the Amorites. They're wicked, but their wickedness has not yet reached its fullness. I will not touch them or touch their land. And so the hills of Judea were left untouched by the wrath of God. Just the cities of the plain were destroyed. And this is a principle throughout the whole of the Bible. And so I've suggested that an easy way to establish that it's not a global flood, but rather a universal flood, is that we have very good evidence that people have not settled Antarctica. You know, even to this day, it's not truly settled. People visit Antarctica, but no one has ever lived there and tried to scratch out a living on the land or colonize the place. And that was certainly true before the 19th century. There's no evidence whatsoever of human visitation of Antarctica before the 1800s. And given that human beings had never visited Antarctica, therefore there would be no need for God to flood Antarctica in this Genesis flood context. And likewise, I would take the position, therefore, that Noah did not have emperor penguins on board the ark. there'd be no need for Noah to take emperor penguins on board the ark, because no emperor penguin got close enough to a human being to be tainted by the reprobation of that human being. And so God, in his mercy, would have left those emperor penguins alone. And I think we could probably develop a correlation there that likewise there's a good chance there weren't polar bears on board the ark either. Because I can't imagine the peoples of that time ever getting up around Spitsbergen or Greenland or northern Canada to make contact with polar bears. Yes.
Such a big issue. It's almost as if it questions your salvation.
That's right. In fact, there's a number of Christian organizations and churches that put that into their doctrinal statement. We will not let you join this church unless you sign off that you accept that the flood was global and that all the geological features we see in the planet were generated by the Genesis flood. I've gotten into a lot of trouble because I'm not prepared to sign that kind of statement. But a lot of other people have. And it's a very good question. Why has this happened? Because, you know, 100 years ago, no Christian organization or church demanded that people sign off to a global flood. Very few people ever heard of it. By the way, the global flood interpretation was around before the 20th century, but very few people espoused it. It's only since 1923 that it's been widely espoused. And you say, what's the big deal in 1923? That's when an amateur geologist published a book called The New Geology, in which he proposed that the flood was global, and that the geology of the planet was caused by this Genesis flood. And he also saw it as an excellent way to put Darwinian evolution in its place. But if you read the book, I think you get an answer to your question. Throughout the book, there is this very strong tenor of anti-intellectualism and anti-scientism. I mean, the fact that it was written by an amateur geologist, and the fact that he was so demeaning towards a professional geologist, I think really helps answer what's going on there. I mean, a word that you see throughout the book is he's accusing academics of suffering from the disease of university-itis. So it kind of gives you what's going on there. And see, this is the time when a lot of evangelicals and fundamentalists were really feeling beat up by the Darwinists. And so there was a sentiment, a strong sentiment within the church. We have to do something to throw off the shackles of these academics. And George McCready Price, in his book, The New Geology, gave them the perfect excuse. The book sold like a wildfire. I mean, it just sold extremely well in the Christian community. And that was really the foundation of flood geology. In fact, the term flood geology didn't even exist in the English language until this book was published.
I think there's still a lot of
anti-intellectualism in the church. Definitely. I mean, flood geology is still alive and well. I mean, very few Christians have heard of George McCready Price's book, The New Geology, but, you know, the sequel to it by Henry Morris and John Whitcomb called The Genesis Flood has sold over 3 million copies. And it was published in 61, and interestingly, they gave almost no reference to George McCready Price's book. But George McCready Price is really the father of flood geology. And in that sense, also the father of this anti-intellectualism and the anti-scientism within the church. Yes. Yep. Yeah, we're going to talk about that. I don't think I'll get to it today. You know, and kind of the strategy I'm taking through these Bible science issues, let's begin with the biblical response first, then follow it up with the science. And I'm going to encourage you to do that when you talk to people that are ardent flood geologists. If you start with the geology and say, you know what, George McCready Price and Henry Morris, they're terrible geologists. They don't know what they're talking about. This is all bogus science. You will typically turn your audience off. they'll say, well, you know, this is just, again, this arrogant university-itis that's being thrown back at me. And because there is that anti-science, anti-intellectual tenor within the movement, and by the way, I'm not trying to say that every flood geologist has that disease, but a number of them do, in which case you're far better off to begin with a biblical response first. They're not going to listen to a scientific rebuttal until they first appreciate that there is very strong biblical evidence to counter the flood geology position. You know, they see that the Bible, literally read, negates the global flood. Then they're going to be much more willing to listen to the response of geophysicists. But I can tell you right off the bat that you're not going to find any secular geophysicists or geologists who will give any credibility to flood geology. And that's a prime reason why Christianity is not being given a fair hearing in the academic community. They say, well, gee, if being a Christian means believing in a global flood, I'm not even going to open the book. It's not worth it. Forget it. Because the evidence is so utterly overwhelming. But it's hard to convince a proponent of flood geology that it is overwhelming without first giving a biblical reason. By the way, that's why we're in trouble at the CHIA convention. They have this idea that we had reasons to believe pay way too much attention to science. And what they were looking for us was a doctrinal statement where we were willing to repudiate science as having any value in biblical interpretation. And I said, well, I can't do that and still call myself a Christian. Because the Bible is the one that tells me that, you know, God does reveal himself through nature. But what that, again, is a symptom of the young earth global flood movement is that they're very nervous that anyone was going to give more weight to scientific evidence than what the Bible says. And so beginning with a biblical response, I think, is just a wise strategy. Yeah, go ahead.
Isn't that in big conflict? Because if you're teaching your kids at home, one of the things you want to be sure is to do is to give them a good grounding in math and science. And so if you're taking a position here that's kind of anti-science, how do you deal with that conflict?
Well, that's what I was telling people at the convention yesterday. I said, you know, if you're a Christian home educator, you must expose your children to secular textbooks. I mean, you're trying to prepare your child for the world. And if all they see is Christian material, and particularly if that Christian material is viewed as being marginal by secular society, how is your child going to make it when he has to make a living in the real world? At least expose them to what the secularists are saying. And it says, how encouraging to your child's faith for them to read secular books and see that it supports the Christian conclusions of the Christian authors. So that's what you really got to do. But, you know, there's a lot of people at the convention that don't want to say that to the Christian home educators. So that's kind of the battlefield we're in. But I'll tell you, there are so many of these parents who came by and said, thank God you're here. They kind of see us as a light in a place where there is a lot of anti-intellectualism. And I think that's happening because there's so many Christians today who are leaving the organized school system because they want to give their children a higher quality education. They say, we're not getting it in the public schools. We're not getting it in the private schools. We're going to do it ourselves. I mean, I met a lot of PhDs yesterday who just came by and said, you know, I've had it with the education system. We're going to do it ourselves. And it's those parents that are wanting to make sure their children get the best possible exposure to science and math and history, geography, etc. So I think that's going to help turn the tide in the Christian home education market. I mean, we also saw a lot of these ladies with these white hats on that looked like they were from an Amish community in Pennsylvania, but the movement is starting to become more diversified. And hey, if you're in Los Angeles, it's kind of hard for it not to be. So, yeah, it's over here. One time only. It was about eight, nine years ago that they had me speak. And it was standing room only, and people were incredibly enthusiastic. And several members of the board said, never again.
That was at CHIA.
That was at CHIA, right. So we've had a booth every year, but they've never allowed me to speak since that first time. So,
write-up in the Sunlight curriculum, which was very good. I was quite surprised.
Well, that's why we're in this year. If it wasn't for Sunlight curriculum, we wouldn't be there this year. We would have been off their convention list. But Sunlight rescued us. The day after that Sunlight published that, we got a phone call saying, we had a cancellation. Would you like to take the booth space of the cancellation? I mean, it was literally hours after that thing hit the press. So I really have to give the credit to Sunlight. And that was a very nice piece they wrote. And I found a lot of Christian home educators have a real high respect for Sunlight curriculum. So, yeah, credit where credit's due. Anyway, back to the theme at hand. Okay. So, yeah, people don't get to Antarctica. God's not going to judge Antarctica. What I want to do in the remaining time is show you that this theme of the entire face of the earth or the whole world or all the surface of the earth elsewhere in the Bible takes on local context, and that we really have to follow the rule of grammar in every language, that phrases of that nature, the whole face of the earth, the whole world, must be interpreted in the context of the antecedent. Whose whole world, whose whole surface? And we saw the example of the dove compared to Noah. Big difference. Noah's perspective is radically different from the dove's. Let me take you to a few other places in the Bible. One is also in Genesis, chapter 41, and this is the story of Joseph. And it's the one about the famine that began to develop in the country of Egypt. It said, when the famine had spread over the whole country of Egypt, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout all of Egypt. And all the countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in all the world. So here again, it uses the phrase, all the world. But as you look at the context of this flood of Egypt, referring to this famine in Egypt, is it really meaning that the kings of the Incas, for example, journeyed all the way to Egypt to buy food from Joseph? Certainly not. This talking about the countries around Egypt. Egypt at that time was considered to be the dominant empire. I mean, if you look at a historical atlas, you'll see at this particular time there was only one nation in the Middle Eastern area that had any power. That was Egypt. So the Egyptian Empire was kind of like the Roman Empire, in that the leaders of the Egyptian Empire considered themselves rulers of the whole. The Egyptian Empire extended into Mesopotamia, extended down into what is now Sudan, and into Libya, and throughout all of Canaan, and up into parts of Turkey, and that was it. That was the full extent of the Egyptian Empire. And yet the Egyptian pharaohs referred to themselves as rulers of the whole world. And so I think it's in that context that we have Joseph feeding the entire world with the grain that he had stored up. He didn't store up enough grain to feed all the peoples of the entire planet. He stored up enough grain to keep Egypt going and all the nations in which Egypt was having a dominating influence. That's what it means by the whole world. Now, let me give you another example, another Old Testament example, and this is in 1 Kings. And this concerns King Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 23, says, King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom that God had put in his heart. Year after year, everyone who came brought gifts, articles of silver, gold, robes, weapons, spice, horses, mules, etc. Then it gives a list of all the wealth that Solomon was able to accumulate from the visitors of all these kings from all the nations of the world. But again, do we interpret this as meaning that the Aztecs in Mexico sent a delegation over to have an audience with Solomon and bring gifts and then go back to their home country? Or likewise, the Maoris in New Zealand or the Aborigines in Australia? No. Again, it's referring to all the kings that would have had the possibility of even hearing that Solomon had existed. Yes, in the back. Well, again, I think it's a 20th century context. The reason why George McCready's book sold so well is by 1923, you had a large number of individuals on our planet who were global in their thinking. And so, for example, if you were a New York financier in 1923, when you talked about the whole world, you really did mean the entire planet.
We had just finished World War One, right?
Right.
World War.
Right.
The whole world involved in the war? No.
No.
Wasn't. But it was called World War One.
Right.
Or actually, it wasn't called World War One. It was just called the World War.
The Great War, yeah.
The Great War. And so here again is another interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Well, World War Two was called World War Two, even while it was being fought.
Yep.
So... Yeah, and it went back to World War One. But again, yeah, it didn't involve all the nations of the earth. So, and when the United Nations was formed, it was referred to as a worldwide confederation of nations, and there were only 45 nations involved, initially anyway.
Are all these references you're giving, do they have the same root word in Hebrew?
Okay. The question is, what about the root word for world? That root word is eres. Okay, and it's got five different literal definitions. Okay, it can mean the entire planet. That's one of the definitions of that word, eres. That would fit what you see in Genesis 1:1, for example. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the eres, the heavens and the earth. In that case, it refers to the entire planet. It can also refer to the geographical territory of a nation. So, for example, we could use the word eres to refer to all the land that would be referred to as Egypt. Or you could use it to refer to the territory of Egypt and all the nations that are being dominated by the Egyptian politics and economy. That could be the world. Or it could be a province of Egypt. Like, for example, we could refer to L.A. County as the eres. California would be the eres. The United States would be the eres. The United States and Hawaii and Alaska and Guam and Puerto Rico could be referred to as the eres. Or it could be the entire planet. But you know, it can even be broken down finer than that. Probably the one that's broken down the finest would be the land owned by an individual. So, for example, if you own a home here in Southern California, you can refer to your front yard and your backyard as your eres. And so, you know, Abraham would refer to his land as his world, his eres.
That's the same word.
Same word all the way through. So, again, it's in the context of the antecedent. Whose world? So, you know, if I'm talking about my territory, it's just my backyard. That's it. But if I'm talking about territory of the mayor of San Dimas, then that would refer to the whole city of San Dimas and on out. But the maximum is the world. You cannot use the word to refer to our solar system, our galaxy, or our universe. The biggest it could be is the whole planet. But the smallest it could be would be your backyard. Yes.
I want to go back to the 19th century. We were given the scientific community, or the anti-Christian scientific community, was taking shots at Christianity on the basis of the flood. I remember reading some of the arguments in the past, but in effect, they gave us. They put us in that position. They gave us an argument. And we accepted the position in which they put us, which is wrong. It's like, Tom, I'm somewhat old, maybe a mile and a half, 2 miles to the right of town politically. And that should make me, according to what the liberals have to say, a total misanthrope. I should hate all mankind. I don't.
Is the back of your neck red? I mean...
no, but the point I'm saying is we have a tendency to have a position put on us that is not true and accept it and fight the battle from the ground we've been given. And that is a big, big mistake, isn't it?
Yeah.
What you're doing is correcting that. But it's got to get through the people.
It's got to get through, and yeah, you're right. It's a favorite tactic in politics and religion to marginalize people you disagree with.
Yeah.
You know, if I can make them look ridiculous enough, then I won't have to worry about them.
Right.
Pardon me?
Can't spell potatoes. Yeah.
Can't spell potatoes, right. So one of our more intelligent politicians gets marginalized.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, I can tell you that there are a lot of scientists that are rather terrified by the prospects of a certain vice president. So... and they're on all different sides of the political spectrum. Okay. Yeah, right. Okay. Anyway, the whole world sought an audience with Solomon. Clearly, it wasn't the entire planet. It was the whole world of Solomon that sought an audience with him. In other words, any king that could have possibly heard of Solomon was coming to have an audience with him and to give him gifts. And if we just look at the gifts, we realize it's not the whole planet. The gifts itself indicate a locality of riches rather than a globality of riches. Okay, let me give you a New Testament example. And this is one from the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans, chapter 1, verse 8. He says, "First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you Romans, because your faith is being reported all over the world." Okay? So is that really meaning that the Aborigines in Australia had heard about the faith of the citizens of Rome? Let's see. I got a reference to Colossians 1:6. Let's see what's in there. Oh, yeah. Another good one. This is in Colossians 1:6. Talks about the gospel that has come to you, Colossians. All over the world, this gospel is producing fruit and growing. Well, does that mean the Great Commission got fulfilled in the days of the Colossians receiving this letter? No. But it does mean the whole world of the citizens of Colossians were seeing Christian fruit being produced in their territories. Now, as Bible scholars look at this claim in Colossians, and in Romans chapter 1, the recognition is, well, what is the whole world of the citizens of Rome? It was the extent of the Roman Empire. And in that sense, was Paul exaggerating? No, at the time he wrote this letter, the gospel indeed had penetrated into all the different provinces of Rome. It was a penetration. It wasn't that, you know, you had 25% Christians in all the provinces of Rome, but indeed the gospel had penetrated. And that was quite remarkable that it had penetrated that rapidly since the resurrection of Jesus from the cross. But he says, your faith. And, you know, here was Rome, a relatively new church in the Christian community. And Paul encourages them by saying, even though your church is so new, your faith has been heard throughout the whole world, throughout the whole of the Roman Empire. So that's another very good example that sometimes you see phrases of universality that doesn't imply globality. Now I'd like to give you one that refers to the flood itself. This is 2 Peter 3, verses 5 and 6. And Peter refers to these last day scoffers. And he says, these last day scoffers deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and with water. Verse 6, by water also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. Now here we're using the Greek word for world. It's the word cosmos. Okay, now this Greek word could mean the entire universe. It could mean the entire planet. But it's like this Hebrew word, arrest, it could mean a piece of the planet. So, for example, you could refer to your entire nation as the cosmos. However, you can't refer to your backyard as your cosmos. Okay, that doesn't work. And so it doesn't go down quite as far in terms of small pieces of land as the word Eres, and it does allow it to refer to the entire universe. So you say, right. What I find interesting is that Peter chose to qualify cosmos. He threw an adjective in there. The adjective is tote in the Greek, and it means the world at the time the event took place. Now, I would suggest that if Peter really meant that the entire planet was inundated with water, he would have chose a different adjective or dropped the adjective off entirely. The fact that he threw in this particular adjective, tote, I think explicitly demonstrates it's less than the entire planet. The world at the time the event took place. Well, the planet was no bigger or smaller at the time that the flood took place. You know, the planet was still the same size, still the same characteristics. But the world of the pre-flood inhabitants was very different than the world of the citizens of Rome that Peter was writing this letter to, the citizens of the Roman Christians in the Roman Empire. And so he's making a distinction between the world of the people reading this letter and the world of the pre-flood peoples, making the point, now, by the way, your world is a lot bigger than their world. And so that's why you would see that tote, cosmos. Well, I'll tell you what the great irony is. Global flood proponents quote this verse to prove that it's a global flood. And, you know, they just seem to miss that the adjective is sitting there. The world of that time. The world at the time the event took place. They just kind of miss right over it and say this proves that the flood is global. And their point is, well, you know, water existed over the whole face of the earth when the earth was formed, Genesis 1. That's why I read the verse preceding, the fifth verse. Because I think that's what throws them off. They deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and with water. They go back to Genesis 1 and say, well, at that time, there was water over the whole surface of the entire planet. Therefore, verse 6 gets interpreted as meaning there was water over the whole surface of the planet. But I would suggest that they're making the wrong connection between verse 5 and verse 6, and they're ignoring the adjective. They're also ignoring something else. It says that long ago by God's word, not 6,000 years ago, but long ago by God's word, the earth was formed. So again, I wouldn't see these two verses as supporting a recent creation of the earth and a global flood. Rather, you've got adjectives that push it the other way. You know, Peter puts in this word, long ago, and the world at the time the event took place. But I do find it incredibly ironic that people who believe in a young earth, quote verse 5, people who believe in a global flood, quote verse 6. When in fact, these two verses are actually verses that are countering both the recent creation of the earth and the global flood. Okay, that's the last one. But that's a sample of the verses in the Bible that demonstrate you do not have to interpret expressions of universality in the Bible as being global. There's nothing that compels you. In fact, it seems quite the other way, that whenever you see expressions of universality, given all these different examples in both the Old and New Testament, the reader in English needs to be cautious. If you see a universal term, because we're 20th century citizens, we should use examples like this in the Bible as a yellow flag. You know, before I interpret it as global, I need to look at the context carefully and see if it's not simply a statement of universality. And again, if we go back to the flood chapters, what it says about the dove and about Noah would give us cause to pause and say, yes, we really are seeing an expression of universality, but not globality. Now, here's a way to back that up. Okay, if you're a geography student, you go through the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and you know, maybe we're on to something. Do you think people are geographically illiterate today?
Absolutely. I'm a geographer, and I know that for a fact.
Well, okay. I've been...
I'm illiterate.
Okay. I've seen that at Reasons to Believe, is that, you know, I assume, because, you know, I was a fan of geography when I was 9 years old. And, you know, I discovered that, you know, people aren't aware of where the different states are in the United States or the different provinces in Canada, or, you know, the relative positions of different nations in Europe. And I've been told by my wife, you know, Hugh, you can't assume that the average American knows his or her geography. And they may not realize that these places are far apart. Or they may not realize that if you've got Chesapeake Bay in there and you're having to drive around the thing, it might take a while to get around that bay. Or likewise, if you're talking different pieces. And, you know, we used to take for granted everybody had a good education and this stuff. They don't. Okay, what I'm leading up to is this. If you're a student of geography, you can go through the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and you'll notice that there's a geographical shift between Genesis 9 and Genesis 10. Okay? From Genesis 1 through Genesis 9, if we were to remove from discussion the first few verses of Genesis 1, what you discover is there's not a single geographical place name outside the environs of Mesopotamia until you hit Genesis chapter 10. When you get to Genesis chapter 10, the geography is global. Okay, and after Genesis 10, you will find a few examples of global geography. But before Genesis 10, you find zero. It's all within the environs of Mesopotamia. And so you start off with the Garden of Eden, and it mentions four rivers. The rivers that we can identify are rivers that flow through Mesopotamia. Two of the rivers aren't identified, but it's told, we're told in the text that these were four rivers that came together in Mesopotamia. And because the Tigris and Euphrates are rivers that crossed over several times in human history, then most interpreters say that, well, two of the rivers are before the crossover, the other two rivers are after the crossover. It's really the same two rivers. And we're looking at is the Garden of Eden being that junction where the Tigris and Euphrates cross. And if you look at a map of Mesopotamia today, they get very close to one another in two different locations. One in southern Mesopotamia, one in northern Mesopotamia. And we just published an article in Connections making the point that maybe the northern site has preference, because we can also see that that's the site where cultivated wheat began to spread and migrate into all the parts of the earth. It seems to center on that northern juncture where the Tigris and Euphrates come very close together and the Karasatic Mountains of Turkey. So, but moving on from Genesis 2 and getting into the flood chapters, we notice all the geographical place names are in the environs of Mesopotamia. Get to Genesis 10, then suddenly we get a global context. Is it possible, then, that human beings had only settled in the environs of Mesopotamia until chapter 10? Okay. A way to buttress that further is to note the fact that in Genesis chapter 9, God deals with Noah about the failure of human beings to fill the planet. If you go back to Genesis 1, 28 to 30, there you have God commanding Adam and Eve, you are to be fertile and multiply and fill the earth. As we described here before, given that they were living 900 years and the best birth control method they had was the rhythm method without the benefit of thermometers, we would expect that the earth would be filled in less than 700 years. The entire planet could have been filled with 6 billion human beings in less than 700 years. It should have been filled in less than 700 years. What prevented it from being filled was murder. Murder is what stopped the human race from fulfilling the command that God gave to Adam and Eve. And so when the flood is over, but let's just turn to that, because the fact that these two come together, I think, is very significant. Genesis chapter 9. it up to, say, verse 5. To Noah, Noah, you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal, and from each man too. I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God, God has God made man. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply in the earth and increase upon it. Now, the reason why I interpret this as a command given to Noah to actually fill the entire planet with human beings, because if you go back to Genesis 1:28-30, before God tells Adam, you must multiply and fill the earth, he explains to Adam and Eve that their responsibility is to manage the resources, the physical resources of the entire planet for the benefit of all life. And he says, for you to do that, you're going to have to multiply and fill the earth. And you know, we've covered this point before, but in order to fulfill the command to manage the resources of the planet for the benefit of all life, it is necessary that human beings occupy the whole planet. At the very least, you've got to take inventory of the resources. And you can't do that if there's nobody living in Australia. You can't do that if nobody's living in North and South America. You got to get the people there. And we have God repeating to Noah the same command, that he and his descendants are now to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Why? So that the command that God gave to Adam and Eve could be fulfilled by the descendants of Noah. That was his intent. But he prefaces it by saying, you've got to put a stop to this murder. If people start killing one another again like they did in the days before the flood, there's no way you're going to multiply and fill the earth. There's no way you're going to be able to fulfill the command and manage the resources of the whole planet for the benefit of all life. You must put a stop to it. And this is where people get the biblical mandate for the death penalty. But I want to add one little thing. And this is built into our American law today. In the American legal system, there is the death penalty for people who take the life of another. You know, and there are certain restrictions on what kinds of murder or manslaughter the death penalty can be invoked. But just like the biblical law, the death penalty wasn't mandatory, but it was there as a final resort to restrain the expression of murder. And so just like the courts today can look at a murderer and say, you know, we're not going to give you the death penalty, even though we have the right to, we're not going to do it. But God is saying with Noah, you have to stop this murder. Whatever it takes to stop this murder, you do it, up to the death penalty. Now, by the way, what he was saying to him, one life from one life. As you see in the Levitical law, there was a restriction on the Jewish government that they could not kill anybody except the murderer. So, for example, if your father murdered somebody, they couldn't go after you as the father, son, or daughter. They could only go after the murderer, one life for one life. And it was a maximum penalty. If this is what you need to do to restrain murder, do it. Why? Because God wants the human species to occupy the whole planet, and it's not going to happen unless murder is restrained. Hand back there. Okay, he's going to demand an accounting. What does he mean by this? Well, yeah, I don't intend to get into a study of murder. I mean, it's a good thing to do, and there's been some good books written upon it. But one of the things I do like is this biblical concept that what's wrong with murder is that you're robbing another person's labor. God has placed us on this earth to work. And one of the things I've been trying to explain to my son is that, you know, work is supposed to be fun and enjoyable. It's something that we want to do, all right? So when somebody takes away our labor, that's stealing. And that's what's wrong with a murderer. A murderer has stolen somebody else's labor, terminated their life, and they were not able to fulfill the labor that God had placed them on the earth to do. And that's what makes it so such an odorous deed in the perspective of God. You know, here's God who set up all these good works in advance for all of us to do. The problem with the murderer is that he removes that possibility of an individual performing the good works that God had prepared in advance for that person to do. So he says, if you steal another person's labor, you're going to be held to account. And, you know, God's going to weigh that very heavily at the great white throne judgment. Now, it doesn't mean that God can't forgive murder, but for the one who refuses to repent of his sins of rebellion against God, there's a warning here. That's going to weigh heavily at the great white throne judgment. And likewise, we as citizens of the planet need to weigh heavily the consequences of murder. I think that's why God was saying to Noah, this has got to be restrained. It's not good to let people kill one another. It's not good for those who get murdered. It's not good for those who do the murders. This must be restrained. And, you know, I think that's kind of the wisdom our courts are trying to engender today, is that, you know, we didn't have a death penalty. Murder kind of got out of control, and the death penalties come back. Now, it can always be abused. I mean, what we saw in the Soviet Union, for example, they're using the death penalty on political prisoners, not on people who murdered other people, but it got taken out of. And again, the Levitical law is very clear. This can only be used for murderers. It cannot be used for accidental murder. Manslaughter doesn't count. It's got to be somebody who really had the intent of stealing somebody else's labor. Yeah, we need to close. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just wondering, they argue today that death penalty statistically doesn't stop crimes or murder. Would you say that's accurate or properly used statistics, or is that just reflective of the science?
Well, again, this probably isn't the place to get into a debate on the death penalty. But, yeah, the whole point is, are we exercising our penalties against murderers in such a way to restrain murder? And one way to measure that is, does the murder rate go down? If it doesn't make any difference, we might question the way we're applying this. And again, the courts have the right to be merciful. They have the right to extend the law. And because we're human, we may find ourselves executing people who killed that we shouldn't execute and letting people get off that we... And, you know, one set of judges has made the point, how long do people sit in death row before they get the execution? And if it's a really long time, then it really doesn't provide an adequate restraint. And, boy, we start not being very just about it and killing people that shouldn't die and refusing to forgive them, and letting other people get off that shouldn't have gotten off, then, yeah, it's going to have a counter effect. Again, you can go back to the book of Proverbs. When you misapply justice, rather than evil being restrained, it will abound. And so there are murderers that we should be forgiving that we're not forgiving. I mean, Jesus was forgiving when he died on the cross, and, you know, I can think of a few examples where murderers had demonstrated real repentance and they still got executed. And other instances I can think of where murderers showed no repentance at all and they received a pardon. And again, that's going to be counterproductive. But again, we're human. We're going to make mistakes. But Father in heaven, Lord, I pray you would help us to glean as much wisdom from these chapters in Genesis as possible. Not just to defend our faith in a secular society, but also to give people understanding for the ways that you judge, the ways that you show mercy. And Lord, may we learn enough from these passages that we can be compassionate and just in our dealings with one another. In Jesus' name.